Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor and counterculture. My name is Tim Lawrence and I'm here after a nice 6 weeks or so off during the summer with my good friend Jem Gilbert again. Hi Jem, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. It's nice to be back. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Did you have a good summer?
It was really nice, yeah. Yeah, we went away with the kids, as one does, and the whole thing was quite pleasant. How about you?
Yeah, it was good. It was intense. Nikki, my partner's Greek, so we went to Greece, and as everyone knows, it was pretty hot in Greece this year, but it was also really good to be there. And then I went camping with my daughters, and then Nikki joined us in the north of Wales. Although I've been told it's actually the centre of Wales, Snowdonia National Park, anyway, for
everybody,
10 days.
Everyone knows that's North Wales.
Oh, I was told by it someone is north. Where is North Wales? If
of
that
course
isn't?
It's North Wales. Oh, that's right. this is synonymous with North Wales.
Good. Well, that's where I went, and it was the contrast in weather could not have been more extreme. But actually, it was just I don't know. It was beautiful, and it took me quite a long time to get used to waking up in a bed again. I didn't.
Good.
I really struggled to not wait. I was like, waking up in a field was just like the best.
Yeah, it can be very nice waking up in a field.
Yes, and so now here we are again and back in the rhythm of things, back into thinking about or even going to parties and doing the podcast and writing and teaching. Why don't you try and remember where we got to by, I think, the end of July and where we're going to pick up from, I think, sometime around about the middle to just after the middle of September.
Well, we got up to, in our historical narrative, we got up to just about up to 1976, didn't we?
Yeah, we definitely got up to 1976.
That's no question. Focusing on New York, as we often do. And we've decided that we want to pause that historical chronological narrative for a bit because we want to do some more interviews with other scholars in the field of music and music studies. And also because we were getting quite burnt out with the amount of work we were having to do to do that every week. So I think for the next few months, we're going to do every couple of weeks, we'll do something for patrons. And once a month, we're going to be putting out one of these interviews. This is partly because a lot of people we've talked to about the show say they really enjoy it, but they're like a year behind us in the chronological narrative. So we thought rather than churning out those every single week, we ought to ease back a bit because we were getting a bit burnt out. And apologies if you are one of the few people who has committedly listened every single week and wants to carry on doing so. But we're going to keep doing patrons stuff, especially looking at some other developments out from other parts of the world other than New York in the early 70s. So I think the next episode we're going to do for patrons will be something about the great Cosmisch music, the so-called kraut rock of the early 70s. And we're going to be doing this series of interviews.
The first interview is with Gail Wald, who's the author of a couple of books, but one in particular that we're interested in, which is Shout, Sister Shout, which was the first breakthrough biography of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was this kind of, incredible pioneer in guitar playing, kind of with a gospel background, but, kind of effectively part of rock and roll.
I mean, arguably, stylistically, the most important innovator of what would come to be just conventional rock lead guitar playing, I would say.
And almost entirely uncredited within rock culture.
Yeah.
We thought this is going to be a good opportunity to kind of, first of all, just speak to some authors, that we would like to speak to anyway. But then, we also want to speak to authors who've written books basically about this, this key period of the late 60s and the 1970s. I think it's maybe our second interview is with Mark Anthony Neal, based at Duke University, who's the author of many fine books, including What the Music Said. And we just want to get into doing more to explore the politics of soul and funk and disco and the 1970s in general. So spending this new series, series five, you know, focusing on that, will be a way for us to go deeper into some of what we've already done. And it will also be a way for us to kind of jump around to some kind of parallel, you know, topics or topics that, you know, seem to inform what came, you know, what came next, such as Gail Wald, or dig deeper into the New York fiscal crisis. We're hoping to speak to Kim Phillips Fain, author of this book, Fear City, which is a great book. So, and I think the other thing to draw out a little bit is that for, I think it's mainly for patrons. What we are planning to do is, you know, because we were at one point, and there have been a handful of requests asking us, you know, well, when are you going to do more on sort of what's going on in the United Kingdom, for example, or in Europe? And we did feel like wanted to get to that. But when we mapped out a series, although there were lots of good individual episodes in that series, there was something about the overall series that didn't quite feel like it was doing what we wanted. So indeed, what we're going to do for patrons is do some of these episodes that we were planning in this UK-Europe series that didn't quite add up to an entire series, but are also topics that we really want to cover.
So what we're going to do today, the rest of today, we're going to do what we're listening to, which is something we often like to do for patrons. We're going to go through a load of records that we've been listening to recently or that we think are worthy of note, not necessarily tied in any way to the narrative of the show, although there is always a lot from the 70s because that's just who we are. And we might have some comments to make as we go along about some interesting recent developments in the world of music and party culture. Obviously, Burning Man's been in the news. So we might have some things to say about Burning Man, but I think rather than chit-chat for too long, we're going to get on with introducing some music.
You're listening to Love is the Message.
So Tim, you're going to introduce the first record we're going to listen to today.
Yeah, this first record that I want to play is The Flirtations, Nothing But a Heartache.
That's you playing a Northern Soul record. That's very surprising.
I know. It's like, I don't know what's happening to me. I mean, you were going to say that's what we listen to, you know, music from the 70s, and this has become true of me. But what's kind of, and I do really like electronic music still. And I think it's really important to like electronic music and to play it when we DJ and all the rest of it. But in terms of the music that I'm listening to that sounds fresh and exciting, which is the feeling you want when you put on a record in front of people, there's no point putting on something that you think is, you know, it's just like become jaded and boring. And it's just
depends how much you dislike the people you're playing the record. Well,
fortunately, I only get to play in places where I really like the people who go to the parties. So I do want everyone to have a good time. And I want to have a good time myself, to be honest. That's part of the idea, really. And one of the strange things that's happened to me over, I don't know if I'd say it's the last year. Everyone likes to say their taste is eclectic. Okay, so let's just accept that, you know, that's the starting point. And there's lots of things that go on to define what we might like to play in a DJ set. But then there are also tendencies of what's going on within where you're at any particular point. And I don't know, in the last 2 years, I'd say in particular, I feel I'm gravitating much, much more than ever before and much, much more than I would have ever expected to the late 60s and the early 1970s. This kind of pre-disco moment, really, which is not to say I don't like disco. And it's not to say I don't like the music that even came out in the second half of the 70s. Never mind all the rest of it. But there's just something about this this period, which I think we both sort of seem to agree was like this incredible period, like in terms of political optimism and counterculture and social movements and a feeling that change was imminent and that protest was part of people's everyday lives, and they would go from the protesting in the streets to the dance floor. And there's just something about this period which is I can't seem to get an offer right now, which is not to say that is all I play when I DJ, but it is usually a component. And I did sort of reflect, the other thing I thought is that, you know, if anyone is new to the show, you'll soon discover that it's mandatory for me to reference David Mancuso of The Loft at least once every episode. And so what I will just slip in here is that, you know, David was playing incredible music. You know, The Loft started in 1970. We all know that. And you know, he played a lot of incredible records from that period. But when we were hearing David play in London at The Light from 2003 onwards, for example, I don't think he ever played hardly anything from pre-74, 75. I mean, I never heard him play even Eddie Kendrick's Girl, You Need to Change Your Mind. I don't remember him playing Sol Mokosa. I don't remember him playing, you know, a record that I particularly grew to love and play All Our Friends, Gladys Knight, Friendship Train. So there's just this, all these records that I think are part of the canon that for some reason they sort of fell out of favor, even with people who are into 70s music. But to me, there's just a lot of energy there. And this record just captures it. It's kind of, there's an ecstatic energy, you know. And funnily enough, I bumped into this record just doing some weird search for psychedelic soul. I mean, I really got into the production. I mean, everyone's into the productions of Norman Whitfield. So I've just been listening to more and more of that. And in a search for psychedelic soul, this record came up and I just thought, wow. And then, so funnily enough, it's also, as you say, it's a Northern Soul classic. So Northern Soul is one of these topics around the sort of the UK and Europe in the late 60s, the 1970s that we are going to do an episode on. And I know you're pretty into that scene, aren't you, Jim?
Well, I'm interested in it. And it's interesting. I've got plenty to say about it. I wouldn't say I don't really listen. I've never been into Northern Soul. I've sort of tried and never really been into it.
Okay.
But it's objectively fascinating as a sort of social and cultural phenomenon.
So do you think this is a record that's objectively fascinating, or do you like
it? Yeah, it is really interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's important to say, in case anybody doesn't know, Northern Soul is a weird concept in itself, because it's a British generic category that emerged in the 70s, referring to a particular, to some extent, a style of American soul music from the 70s. But it's a pretty loose category. And really, what would define something as Northern Soul was that it was records that would get played by soul DJs at north of England dance parties from the early 70s onwards. But their favoured style, not exclusively, but almost exclusively, was soul music from Detroit and Chicago that characteristically, it often has a slightly faster, more frenetic beat than this, but it has this, characteristically has this kind of melodramatic quality to the lyrics and the strings and the vocals. And that's the quality that this has. And Nothing But a Heartache is just a classic. If you were going to make up a Northern Soul track title, then Nothing But a Heartache would be like, you know, would be... It could be an imaginary Northern Soul record. I always find this stuff quite compelling, like when you hear it, especially when you hear these records for the first time.
Yeah, there's something about the kind of the recording process, like the production process, the 7-inch, you know, the tightness of a 7-inch pressing, maybe. There's a concentrated energy here. And the gospel element that's coming kind of through very strongly in soul music, basically.
Is
what I think we kind of identified probably in series 2, if I'm not mistaken. No, we did this at the beginning of series 3, didn't we? We did like at least one or maybe two episodes on gospel and just kind of tracking gospel's, you know, spread and then, you know, move, obviously influence on soul and then some early disco. And obviously we've talked about this previously, but just the kind of organic the organic feel of the musicianship on these records does give them a sort of timeless feel. Somehow they're, you know, the energy of them doesn't seem to necessarily dissipate over time, or else my ears are not yet kind of got bored of this sound yet, but in 2 years' time they will be, and there'll be something else I'm trying to get my thrills from.
Yeah, that's possible.
Very, very possible. Yeah.
All right, what about the next record?
The next record, I don't have loads to say also because I don't know loads about it, but let's hear it before I even try and talk about it. And this is Antonio Carlos e Trocafi, a Brazilian duo, and the track is called Simbarere.
Classic Brazilian funk, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's like this stuff is so incredibly intense and powerful and layered. And I remember that in season three, we were spending, you know, we were looking at
Afro psychedelia.
Thank you. I don't know why that slipped my mind. I can't believe it slipped my mind. I need to go back to. So re-listen to the archive. So we did the Afro psychedelia, and I remember us both like being particularly kind of enthralled by going through, you know, the three episodes we did on Brazilian music. And there still is something about this period of the late 60s and early 70s Brazilian music. And I think we both sort of concluded also the Brazilian music that wasn't trying to be too Western was sometimes the Brazilian music that we kind of most like, which sounds like we're a bit into kind of, you know, some bad idea of authenticity. But in terms of sheer compelling dynamism, some of the most sublime music I've ever heard recorded. And I'm playing this one because it was the summer, the last All Our Friends party we held. This was just the opening record. And it was a pretty hot period. So having intense layered funk music from Brazil worked well for me. The musicians are Antonio Carlos Marquez Pinto and Jose Carlos Figueiredo, who are singer-songwriters, play guitar, cavaquinho, banjo, and it's these two recording this record in 1969. At the International Song Festival, and it was the year before at the International Song Festival that Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, I believe, were arrested for being, you know, prominent figures, protesters within the Tropicalista movement.
Yeah, it's just a really good example of the way that this Brazilian music from this period combines urgency with complexity, like really in a way which nothing else does to quite the same extent. Nothing else quite manages to combine that funk urgency with a kind of rhythmic complexity. And I guess that's because it's developing out of things like the bossa nova and samba, and it's bringing in these funk elements as well.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
And there's sort of a discordance there, but there's also a melodic element as well, it feels like. And it's just so tight, you know, everything's in 3.5 minutes, I suppose, or 4 minutes. It's a complete explosion of a record.
Love is, love is, love is the message.
Okay, what can follow that?
Well, gonna chill out just a little bit. And this was a surprise to me. Maybe you knew this record for a long time. It wouldn't surprise me if you did, but I had never heard it until recently. And this is Carole King, Believe in Humanity. Yeah, I mean, I'm not the huge Carole King fan, although, you know, clearly she's a, you know, incredibly influential and powerful kind of artist, and I think Tapestry sold 30 million copies or whatever it was, and that came out in 71. I always sort of thought, you know, indeed, sort of just as like aligned her with sort of slightly folkish, slightly rockish kind of, you know, part of that continuum, but being a woman, which was is kind of always kind of welcome to have different voices. But I never like imagined her to be doing music that was kind of obviously danceable. I mean, now I re-listen to I Feel the Earth Move, which was probably her best known record, is on Tapestry. And it's got a lot of, you know, the piano is quite gospel-y, actually. It's a lot more upbeat than I sort of had in my imagination of Carole King, who was much kind of more downbeat and mellow. There is a soulfulness there. But then this record came, I hadn't heard it before, and it's like a really good early disco record, if you like. Like, it's got proper soul and proper feel, but it actually comes out in 1973. It's ridiculous. This is before anyone's even, it's before anyone's even dreamt up what disco might be.
Yeah.
I thought this was Carole King hearing about disco and deciding she needed to do a disco record in order to make some money and appeal to, you know, disco fans. But it's obviously that didn't happen. She did it because she was feeling some kind of, you know, soulful beat. And I think it's Mike Edwards, who's a DJ from the Northern Soul scene. I like to listen to his mixes on Mixcloud. They're really good. It's very, very soulful. So I'm pretty sure I heard Mike play this on one of his records and just really liked it. And I don't know. One thing I was going to say about this is, you know, you have like these lyrics, believe in humanity. I mean, I'm not sure it's the best ever lyric, but there's something again about this period where it's just like you have lots of records that are talking, you know, have a sort of universal consciousness, and they write lyrics and they deliver them, and they don't come across as being banal or cheesy or just like empty or just like somehow just like some empty rhetoric. So this is one of those as well. It's got a utopian kind of feel, which I really like, and I think it's always nice to have some of this kind of messaging
for sure.
I don't know if this is a good opportunity to talk about Burning Man.
Burning Man, it's really, that's a very BBC like 1950s. It's Burning Man. Burning Man.
I'm sorry, I forget that you're actually American, despite your accent.
So, yeah, we could talk about...
You want to actually rant about Burning Man? Or did I say...
Well, Burning Man has been on the news. For people listening in the future, Burning Man, which I assume everyone's going to know what it is, has been in the news globally because... I think for the first time in its history, there was like a heavy rain downpour during the festival, which means that the playa, the desert plain where it's usually held, was turned into mud to the point where vehicles couldn't really drive through properly, and you know, they couldn't get enough water in, and people had to try and get off the site, but they couldn't get off the site because of the mud stopping vehicles from moving. It's all been very sort of chaotic, but also part of the media spectacle of this all happening and being sort of international news, or at least news in the English speaking world. I don't know if it's news in France or Thailand. Part of the media spectacle has been the process by which it has really brought to the foreground the way in which Burning Man has really become a playground for members of the suit of a super rich elite in America. You know, one of the most notorious pictures doing the rounds on social media has been of this guy whose name I don't even remember, but I think he was the Solicitor General under Obama. Neil Katyal is his name. A bigger corporate lawyer, notorious for having defended Nestle in some big court case. And there's a picture of him in like a propeller beanie hat. Like a Burning Man going around, which does really sort of focus people's attention on the way in which Burning Man has gone from being this iconic reference point for a certain kind of international non-conformist psychedelic culture to instead being a symbol of the way in which elements of that Californian post-countercultural psychedelic culture have converged with just a culture of libertarian hedonism amongst, in particular, people associated with the tech sector and a number of people on the political right in the States. I mean, something that's been true for several years now is that there's a contingent of the American libertarian right, including one of the iconic figures of the libertarian right in America, the political organizer and commentator Grover Norquist, who make a point of going to Burning Man every year. So it's really focused people's attention on this phenomenon of this, what at one time countercultural activity and phenomenon, being just completely apparently now inserted into and swallowed up by the culture of corporate elites.
Celebrating the idea that they, you know, the best form of society is one that's completely free of the state.
Yes.
Unless there happens to be some sort of need for the state, such as to get them out of, you know, a flooded area, or to, you know, protect against environmental catastrophe, or have roads that function and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I have plenty to say about it. I wrote a blog post about Burning Man once years ago because our friend Leo asked me to give me a line on it. Even though I've never been to it. I feel bad. The thing is, I feel bad commenting on it. I've never been to Burning Man. I do have friends who've been to Burning Man. My sisters have been to Burning Man, actually, years ago. But I suppose I've been sort of aware of it and sort of in contact with people who were going for, I guess, decades now, actually.
Well, you know, this good friend of mine, and many people within the dance scene, Adam Goldstone, also, you know, tragically died of, heart failure in Burning Man. And this was, I don't know, I really feel like I've lost track of time of when this happened, but it could have been 20 years ago or something. I'd need to look up the date of Adam's passing. I mean, it was very shocking. But back then, of course, Adam, you know, Burning Man was really being celebrated as a center of, you know, of the gathering of different tribes and a place of, you know, free expression. And I'm not even necessarily sure that the point was to kind of, you know, celebrate libertarianism per se, but it was, you know, it was a place where people were gathering and feeling that they, you know, could be expressive and basically explore alternative forms of, you know, community and ways of, you know, organizing and means of transaction. Then the tech sector and all the Silicon Valley kind of billionaires just thought it was, you know, not that far away, and they could go with their entourages and their portable everything instead of just getting in a tent and mucking in. I think just went with this kind of huge convoys.
Well, one of the features of Burning Man was always that one of the things that made it special was that it required a real commitment to go, because you had to equip yourself for like a week in the desert, and you had to get to the desert from wherever you were starting from. I mean, most people would start from San Francisco. And it was a really challenge. But of course, this is an interesting point. I've not quite thought about this before, actually. And it is something relevant for thinking about lots of subcultural and countercultural types of activity. If you put up really high bars to accessibility, if you make your event deliberately accessible on the grounds that therefore only the really underground people, the really special people, the really committed people will go, sooner or later, you're likely to find that another set of people will go, and that is the people who have the wherewithal, the material means to overcome all those bars painlessly, to overcome all those barriers painlessly. But I would say that's certainly true like of festival culture in the UK, for example. But my other podcast, ACFM, has just done a whole episode about festivals. One of my problems with festival culture going back to the 80s was always that, well, you couldn't participate really if you didn't have a car. And today, like going to Glastonbury is going to cost you, like, if you want to take a group of like three or four people to Glastonbury, it's going to cost you a couple of grand, probably. And you've got to have motor transport as part of that. So, well, this is one of the problems, and the problem is how you keep stuff sort of underground, but also make it accessible in ways that don't. It's always a problem that's got to be resolved, and I mean, one of the reasons for me, I got really into The Loft, actually, because I thought that David had sort of come up with a way of resolving that to some extent, that it was this aesthetically very specific practice. And he was sometimes quite, you know, there were barriers to getting in, but there weren't barriers. The barriers to getting in were really about whether, you know, initially it was about whether David or people around The Loft thought you were, you know, aesthetically, philosophically, politically cool. And it wasn't, because it was really expensive and it was in a place where most people in the world don't live in New York City with easy access to Manhattan, but more people live there than live in most other places. So, well, also, I mean, arguably the whole system, the whole like Loft Ideal system, where you have a kind of a membership and there's a kind of, yeah, you get regular mail outs and stuff. And that was how things were going right back to the 70s. You can compare it to just a kind of public commercial club night that's open and anybody can go who comes and buys a ticket. But compared to lots of other things, compared to something where like it's really only word of mouth and you have to know everyone before you get in, it's actually pretty accessible. It's a way of making something sustainable. But also, like, once you knew about it, it's very easy. Just you get a membership, you get a letter every few months telling you when the next party is, and you go to the party with your membership card and you go in. And it's actually very low, it was a very low barrier to entry and a very low barrier and an extremely low barrier to continued participation once you had got in. And there's an interesting contrast there and I think that illustrates the point that there's a real danger of erecting high barriers to entry, even though people who want to preserve the underground status of events often do so with that intention.
The one thing I wonder about is what, you know, the, you know, old timers who've been going to Burning Man for 30 years feel, and if they feel that, you know, clearly there's another side to it that still feels very real.
It's important to say this. I mean, my sense is that there are still a lot of burners who've been burning for decades now. And one thing about the nature of the event, because it's so dispersed when it happened, it's so large and it's dispersed. And apart from the big burn, there isn't really a kind of central point to it. It means that, and this is similar to Glastonbury actually as well, but it's like multiple zones. It means that, well, if you are one of those people, you can still go and have pretty much the same sort of Burning Man that you were having 20, 30 years ago. Well, not 30, but 20 years ago, you don't really have to interact with like Elon Musk in his RV or whatever. But arguably, that's one of its strengths. And I think that's obviously that is part of its appeal for people. But then the problem with it, I would say it does exemplify a point that I've made many times before, including when commenting on Burning Man, that, well, if you do something creative and innovative, like whatever it is really in any sphere, if it has any kind of dynamism, any energy, any juice, the capitalists will start sniffing around. They will come and they will want a piece of it and they will take a piece of it, unless you have a quite deliberate and explicit political project to prevent them from doing so. And, you know, Burning Man comes out of that 90s really sort of post-political culture that was very much, it has to be said, the sort of the culture of most bohemians of our generations. You know, it was the end of history. It was the 1990s. And it was very, and they were very big on not having a politics, basically. They're very big on having like an ethics, as they would describe it, but not a politics. And I would say that is a strategy that never succeeds. That is a strategy that always delivers up your project for capitalist parasites to feast upon. And there's just no getting away from that, as uncool and boring as it might be to have an explicit politics.
I think we should listen to some more music.
Yeah.
And we've got up to 1974 and we've got up to some of your music.
I've got a couple of records from 1974 to play. They're both records I have been DJing actually repeatedly this year. The first is Miriam McCabe, from her 1974 album, A Promise. Miriam McCabe, we've talked about on the show plenty, South African singer, the iconic South African singer of the anti-apartheid generation, arguably. Well, not really arguably, but she is. We've played her before.
Series 3 we went to.
And we've played on what we're listening to before. We played a Miriam McCabe track before.
Yes, yeah.
And this is another one. And this is, this is one of those tracks, like I played it. And I played it to a big crowd and everyone went crazy, and friends of mine, including people who have more records than me, like, were really surprised that this was a Miriam Makeba track on an album that lots of people own and nobody had really noticed before. So yeah, really great track. It's called We Gotta Make It, and I mean, the lyric is very profound. The lyric is very explicitly addressing a community in struggle and saying nobody is coming to save us. We have to save ourselves. Fantastic track. The way this is one of those instances where it's frustrating that copyright rules prevent us playing more than a few seconds. You really have to hear the track for yourself, because the way that it builds over its 4.5 minutes is pretty extraordinary.
I think my comment that I made when I wrote down my response was, wow. It's just like unbelievable, this music. It's just unbelievable. I mean, it just keeps coming back to the things I've sort of half said. This late 60s, early 70s period has just got some of the finest music ever recorded. And there's just like the power of the musicianship and the lyrics and the vocal delivery and the productions is just, I just think it's sensational.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Yeah, thank you, Miriam Makeba, and everyone involved in recording this album. And so my other record from 1974, this is Max Romeo. I think I've played Max Romeo before on the show. And this is another one of his political anthems. This is Max Romeo, Rent Crisis.
My landlord is a cruel man, a man that no one can understand. Every time the rent near fit you, that is the time when my landlord screw. And when him collect, him smile again. That's the only time me and him a friend. But that friendship only lasts for 3 weeks. That's 3 weeks time, the rent you again.
So that is Max Romeo's anti-landlord anthem, which I think is highly appropriate given the deep crisis in housing costs afflicting so many people in London and really in cities all around the world now. Hmm. Extremely, extremely timely, extremely topical. I've taken a vow to play this very short record in every DJ set I play until something is done about the housing crisis in London, until rent caps are introduced in London. I won't stop playing that. So take that, landlord class, like quake in your shoes, because I'm going to keep playing Max Romeo at parties you've never heard of.
There's lots of different versions of suffering within roots reggae, but I don't know if I've heard a roots reggae talk about the suffering of paying the rent before, at least not so directly, like lyrics about landlords. It's fantastic.
All right. So what's your next one? Is it your one next?
Well, this was a bit of a surprise when we were trying to work out the chronology, although I had kind of already surprised myself by checking. And then I think, Jem, you got surprised as well.
Yeah.
So well, let me first introduce the record, which is the Universal Togetherness Band, Ain't Gonna Cry. So yeah, this kind of, if you look up, you know, you buy the album, let's say, it's released in 2014. And so without looking too carefully at what was actually happening, I thought, oh, fantastic. You know, here's a new record, a record born deep into the age of electronic music that features live musicianship and a really compelling groove that, you know, feels like it could have been recorded in the 1970s. It's like amazing. And it's just got, it's got this freshness to it. It's got, it's got an unbelievable kind of bass line. It's very floaty. It's kind of irrepressible. And I really like I like the style of the female vocal. It's not the vocal of a kind of really like powerful gospel singer necessarily or soul singer, but it's very catchy and very sort of knowing and very assured and confident. Which I think works well. So I really thought this is a great record and really great to be able to record this record in 2014, only to then to discover that it was actually, of course, recorded sometime between, I'm not sure anyone has an exact date for this, but sometime between 1979 and 1982. And you know, once again, you have the name of a band, the universe, or basically a kind of a sequence of words, the universal togetherness band that is just fantastic. Like what an incredible name for a band. And there's something about their sound that, you know, captures their name. It's ergonomic somehow almost. And apparently it's a Chicago group who came together within Columbia College, and they were somehow became connected to an audio engineering program, and they were performing in the recording studios of this engineering program, basically I think jamming and maybe working with students involved in the recording process. I'm a little unclear about how their involvement, all this came about and played out, but basically this band formed in Columbia College and recorded in Columbia College for these three years. So yeah, this is one that I just heard this fairly recently. Actually, this was my youngest daughter Ilaria, and we were driving to Wales to go camping, as I mentioned at the top of the show. I went camping with the girls. Carlotta had had a late night the night before, so she was asleep in the back, and Ilaria was DJing whilst I drove. And yeah, Ilaria's picking up some really good records. And this was one of them. So I was like, yeah, thank you. So yeah, I just got the vinyl is on order.
Yeah, I'd never heard it before. And I also, when I looked it up, it said 2015. And I thought it did sound like one of the contemporary soul groups. I mean, there is this generation of artists making soul music in a classic style, and often the production is unsurprisingly a bit cleaner and the sound a bit tighter than you would normally expect from then. So that's what I thought it was, but yeah, it's not. That is really interesting. It's very interesting, that story about the genesis of the music, because I wonder if in some ways that's quite similar to what a lot of more recent soul music would be like as well. It's a sort of quite deliberate exercise in trying to create a certain sound, and that doesn't stop it working. It can work really well, as this illustrates. Okay, we're up to 1987.
This feels weird to be this far into the out this far outside of the 1970s. Yeah. But I suppose we should say we are used to doing this when we do these. What we're listening to, we move around a lot,
and one day we will get out of the 70s in the historical narrative of the show. We should have said that already. We will eventually one day do that.
I don't know why you make promises you can't necessarily keep, Jim.
All right, well, we might. It's Pharoah Sanders, who died this year. Great, great saxophonist, great mainstay of spiritual jazz. Led many great bands and featured on many great records by other people. Going back to the classic run of Alice Coltrane albums on which he usually plays sax. And this is from 1987. I think there's a lot of great jazz from this period, actually. There's a lot of great jazz from sort of 82 to 87, 88, but often a lot of it quite obscure. You know, jazz wasn't selling at all when in those days, but there were people who'd kind of come up through the... We'd come up through the jazz scene of the 60s and 70s, coming to maturity. I guess people like David Murray at that time. But Sanders was from a slightly older cohort than them, but he still did some really good work in the 80s. And this is one of my favourite Pharoah Sanders tracks. Oh Lord, Let Me Do No Wrong. Yeah, the lyric and the music really express Sanders's famous sense of spiritual earnestness in a very direct way. And it's relatively accessible compared to a lot of his music, which often goes into very, very intense, you know, free jazz, soprano sax territory. So it's really a favourite of mine. And yeah, it's good to have something from Pharoah Sanders in the year of his passing.
It's kind of, it certainly comes across as being sort of mellower at the start of the track than is normal for a Pharoah Sanders track, but it doesn't, it then gets, you know, some full intensity emerges, yeah, which I think is really good, actually. I was kind of, I didn't want him to get, I was kind of wondering if it would be sort of too lulling at one point, maybe. There's nothing wrong with lulling, but I was interested to see where it ended up, and I don't think in the end he couldn't resist, but kind of go for some power.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. It's 1994.
Yeah, we are into electronic music. It's shocking, I know. and I'm, you know, yeah, I'm constantly, I don't know, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but I just can't help it. And I'm constantly trying to listen out for or hear electronic records that feel fresh to me. And somewhat bizarrely, one goes back to the late 80s or even the early 90s quite often for that feeling. Not always, but quite often. And so this one is Underworld, Dark and Long, and it's the Spoon Deep Mix. So this is a 1994 release. It was on the original version is on the album Dub No Bass With My Head Man. And did I pronounce that correct? Did I?
Yes, I think so.
Is that
yes.
Okay?
Yes.
It's more like Dub No Bass With The Head Man.
Yes.
It's all one
That's
word.
That's how you're supposed to pronounce it.
Thank you. Dub No Bass With My Head Man. You are the authority on pronunciation on this show. Self-appointed. Anyway. So this is definitely an album that I had, and it's definitely an album that at some point I got rid of, and probably, you know, and now it's like, why? So I can't, I didn't actually check. I didn't quite have, well, I probably did have time, but I had a lot else going on. So I just know that this particular track, the Spoon Deep Mix, lasts for 20 minutes. So I want to mention a guy called Jack Prendergast, who's been helping out all our friends and just coming to dance with us as well. Sometimes sends through some listening suggestions, and a good number of them have been really, really great to check out. And this was one that actually Jack reminded me of just maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago. He'd sent it to me before, and I'd listened, and I thought it was great. And I thought, like, but it's 20 minutes. It's like, where can you play a record that's 20 minutes long? And, you know, well, maybe I'd want to listen to it at home as well, but... It's just a long record. And I re-listened, and I just decided that it's actually pretty, it's pretty epic. And it's an awesome lull is, you know, lulling in a different way to the Pharoah Sanders, but there is a lulling quality to it, and it just keeps on opening out, and it's got an interesting propulsive kind of element, but is quite got, you know, also a sort of somewhat ambient element and psychedelic element as well. David Mancuso would play electronic tracks. He wanted to play new music, and he found a lot of electronic music was had a quite transcendental kind of quality to it, and he liked it. He liked long tracks. Now, he didn't, to the best of my knowledge, he never played this, although he was very into the Orb, Orb albums, although I think he might play those, you know, in the early hours of a party once, post the peak and stuff. I have no idea whatsoever what David might have made of this, but I did sort of think that there was something about this aesthetic that he would tune into. And,
yeah, he was into this sort of dubby progressive house. When he first started coming over to London, it was the thing that our friend Simon Halpin and I, we used to find the most, I remember we would talk about this, it was the thing we found most surprising, most unexpected, that this guy from New York, from the village, you know, was coming over. But quite a bit of what he was playing was a sound that we associated with raves and nightclubs of the mid-90s in Britain. And he definitely did resonate with that sound a lot.
I mean, Lucky Cloud Sound System, which celebrated its 20th anniversary recently, and, you know, at a meeting just before that anniversary, the team decided that the party would evolve into two parties, which, you know, these things happen, and we've been working together for a long time, and I think it's all very positive, and, you know, different forms of expression are going to come in, and I'm going to have a role, or I do have a role, within half of this evolution, the half that is continuing with the name Lucky Cloud Sound System. The other party is going to be called the London Loft. Yeah, so I'm just, you know, I'm let's just say I'm thinking about records that, you know, could be brought into that situation potentially, as we kind of think about taking the party forward. So it's partly with that in the back of my mind that I, you know, listened to this and rethought about it, and it's not to say that yes, I think this would work in that situation, but, you know, I guess it's a question that I think is quite interesting to play around with a little bit.
Historically as well, I mean, historically Dubner Bass from a Headman and Leftfield's Leftism from the following year are probably the sort of iconic British dance albums of the period, and the iconic expressions of progressive house. I'm going to say it again. All right, so we're going to move into the 21st century for the last couple. I thought we would have Omni Trio, Higher Ground from 2001. Yeah, Rob Hayes, on recording as Omni Trio, I guess, like, along with people like LTJ Bookham and some other producers, really a pioneer of the ambient drum and bass sound. And this is a great example. I think this is just a great example. The, you know, this is the kind of potential solemnity of the drum and bass being offset by the almost ambient pianos. And I think it's a really, I've been listening to quite a lot of this stuff recently, and when I played it DJing as well, people really get massively into it. We might have talked about this on the show before, like in the 90s, there was a lot of controversy over this kind of music, and some people like Simon Reynolds were very dismissive of people like Bookham with their fusion influenced turn towards ambience and psychedelia in drum and bass, and what they wanted was hard, fast, dark, hyper-urban drum and bass instead. And I sort of think there's a certain value in recovering this psychedelic strand of drum and bass, which people are still making records like this a bit, but I think it's a kind of strand of music which has a lot of potential and is really expressive of a sort of Afro psychedelic aesthetic, and can be very, very affecting. The way it can offset melodic potency with rhythmic complexity, when it works, it can be very, very affecting. And the last track I thought I would play, because I am committed to trying to play, you know, the stuff I've bought this year sometimes, was this track by Brother, who's a French producer, although I think he's based in Lisbon. And this is a track called Sundials. This, I thought, I really like this. It's a very much a kind of workman-like exercise in jazz house, but the sax playing, I think, is really nice, and the overall production is really nice. It's not a groundbreaking record. It's a functional record to some extent, but it's a record in a very well-established style, but I think it executes it very nicely, and I think that's as much as one can ask for a workaday 12-inch a lot of the time these days. So I actually really like it, and I wanted to play it because it's the record I bought last week, basically. I don't think it's one I'm going to be necessarily listening to in 20 years time or 40 years time, but I think it's a really it's a good example of how this kind of thing, which is can be easy to dismiss, it can be done well if the musicianship is there, and I think it is on this record. It's definitely definitely one from the end of summer playlist, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was a good record. I mean, it sort of reminded me of records I think I already might have or have heard, that, and I might prefer some of those. And if it costs like 20 quid on Juno or whatever, then I might be like thinking, do I really want to buy this? But it's incredibly important to bring in new music, and it's a good record. I liked it.
All right, that's a nice selection of records. I didn't play it. That's the closest I got to playing any actual jazz this time.
Yeah, what the hell's going on? You've deprived the regular listenership of your international anthem selection.
No, I know. I have to get back to the international anthem. I might do a whole selection of Gondwana tracks next time. But that'll do for now. All right, thanks, yes. Thanks, Tim. That was really interesting.
Jim. Yeah, it was fun.
Thanks, everyone. And we hope you enjoy the next few months of the show.
Yeah, so just to, you know, reiterate, this is something we do occasionally for patrons because it seems like a fun thing to do, and I think we think that people quite like it, so we thought it'd be a nice way to just do a relaxed introduction to, you know, this coming series and to reacquaint ourselves. It's been a pleasure.